The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Melt-up talk is all the rage. The Fed seems to be off its game. Markets close the week slightly higher after unemployment report is the best in 50 years. All this and much more on episode number 610 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And welcome to May. This is Andrew Horowitz, and you know, it's been a pretty loud couple of days here in Fort Lauderdale. We've had Fleet Week here, and the planes are flying overhead. First of all, they were practicing last week, so about Thursday and Friday, they're about set 11 o'clock to 12 o'clock in the afternoon, 1 o'clock. They were flying overhead, the Blue Angels and a variety of other jets, and making just incredible racket. Powerful, massive, incredible, just so impressive. And that's been going on. And today we're going to have some more. We were able to see right out of our windows from our office them flying by, but the noise and the incredible engine roar has been just, it just reminds you of how much power we have. And that's pretty cool. But we're talking on our new Podcaster Studio setup. This is the Rodecaster Pro. And hopefully we get the settings right. It's going to probably take a few weeks to get the settings exactly like we want to hear them, like we want them to sound, a crisp, nice, bold sound. But we were working on this. It is a great little setup. Basically, instead of having, let's see, we had two different microphone input systems and amplifiers and all sorts of different settings. This does it all in one. And then on top of that, the wiring. Whereas in the past, we have to do what's called a mix minus to get certain things out and into Skype and when we're talking with guests. This is incredibly easy to set up. And it just works. And they keep on coming out with updates on a regular basis, even though there's a relatively new product. There's a touchscreen on it. There's all sorts of really cool things for sound. So hopefully this is going to do the trick because it actually makes it really easy to also be portable. Let's say that I wanted to do a show, I don't know, somewhere else. Just pick this up, take your computer, and you're ready to go. So I'm really impressed with this product. We'll see again what the output is, if you can even hear any. Hopefully you won't be able to hear too much of a differential because we want it to sound, you know, pretty much like it sounded before. But we'll see. A few people that I know have been looking forward to my review on this. So far, aside from the output and aside from getting this podcast done, it sounds really good. And I'm really thinking that this is an excellent solution. A few things I wanted to get to before we get into the meat of the show. I want to mention that May, here we are, it's May. And I thought I would do something kind of special during this month. So all new clients that come into the Investology platform. It has a $10,000 minimum. It's globally diversified. You can find out more at investology.com. But I wanted to let you know that, first of all, we have been designing this and putting it together, this robo-esque type of investment platform that's advisor-crafted and technology-enhanced. Starting in May, anybody that comes in May that starts their process of building a portfolio in May and has the entire process where you build it and then you open the account and fund the account and we have it managed, we'll be getting a book, The Disciplined Investor, the book that I wrote, and an Investology challenge coin. You know, we had this really successful launch and now we're about a year or so into it and this testing of the system and the processes that go into it. Now we're ready for you. We're ready. So I wanted to entice you a little bit, but give you some reason to maybe think about it and say, okay, you know what? It's time. I'm going to take a look at this. So go over to investology.com with an E. And what you could do from there also is that you can go to the, on the top, it says client login, or somewhere it says start modeling your portfolio or start creating your portfolio. Any of those buttons takes you right through a free registration process where you can just simply go on, check it out, see what's going on. But if in fact you start it and fund it in May, you're going to get a copy of my book. I'll sign it and I'll give you a this really nice little challenge coin that we have for Investology as well. Also, I want to mention that for all of you who have recently provided us with an idea for a guest, I had put it out on Twitter that said, hey, you know what? Who do you want on the show? Who do you want to hear? Who do you think would make a really good guest for this podcast? You sent me a lot of different names and we've been in contact with many of them. I want to thank you very much for that. We're working on getting some of these people on the show. And if you know anybody that maybe you have their contact information, send them an email. Say, hey, you know what? Have you thought about being on The Disciplined Investor? Why don't you give them my contact information, the information about the website, of information about the podcast, and have them come on over. Introduce themselves. Now, I think this is the last thing I want to talk about here. There's a couple things I want to go through because interesting situation what's going on. But every so often, I give you some insights into what's going on from a different perspective, from the area of what's happening with regard to the markets, the economy in a different slant. Because what we know of is, of course, that we saw this great employment number that came out, 3.6% on the unemployment rate, the lowest in 50 years. We saw that, you know, upwards of high 200,000s were added, and it's been going on consistently besides one little blip a couple of months ago. And we know that manufacturing is slowing a bit, but holding in there. Consumer confidence is looking okay. Housing's been hit or miss, but generally speaking, been holding out pretty well and doing pretty, just fine. But one of the things that we look at is what's happening with the internals with stocks. And one of the ways that we pick stocks, particularly for the managed growth strategy, the TDI managed growth strategy, is we do a first line quantitative screen, a filter of sorts, a way of weeding out certain stocks that don't meet certain appropriate criteria, we'll call it. Now, what does that mean? So we start out with about 5,000 stocks because the universe of stocks out there. Now, not all of them will qualify because they could be preferreds or other issues, et cetera. But what we do is we start looking for, okay, return on equity. Did you meet this particular number that we feel is a reasonable level of return on equity? How about growth of earnings? Are you continually growing your earnings, not going negative, at least having some positive level of earnings? Same thing with revenue. What about margins? Are we seeing margin expansion? There's a whole host of things that go into what we believe are the criteria for stocks from a fundamental basis that will give us an idea of how things are doing, plus how we actually fill up and create a portfolio. So here we are. Usually what we see is somewhere around, I would say, on average, 50-ish, 55 to 75 stocks in a good market condition. In other words, where the underlying fundamentals are so good that we see a pretty high number of stocks that make it through that very rigorous screen. That may not seem like a lot, but again, we're trying to really weed out those stocks that don't meet certain growth criteria and valuation criteria and volume and just a whole host of things that will give us some insights of what's happening with stocks in general. So for about, I would say the last year, give or take, there was a pretty high level of stocks in there. Good amount of stocks that made the grade, that made the cut. They were able to get through this rigorous screen. And then more recently, in the last 4 months, we're starting to see a change. All of a sudden, we dipped down to about 50 stocks about 3 months ago. Why is that? Well, we saw that earnings growth wasn't there anymore at the same level for a lot of companies. And revenue growth was having some difficulty as well. Those were two criteria that was important. The second, third issue was also margins. Margins were not expanding and at all like they were for last year or so. Now, a lot of that is predicated on the fact that we had this really good benefit to stocks due to the tax cuts that they got. And that really enhanced their earnings, not the revenue, but the earnings and their margins. So those two things were really popping. I mean, really popping. So here we are fast forwarding into a situation where now we have a much more reduced number. Now, what does that say? What does that tell us? What it says is that the environment for stocks, regardless of what stocks are doing in terms of price for the moment, we'll get to the technicals in a second. What that tells us is fundamentally the underpinnings of the economy or the underpinnings of what's happening on a global basis, something is not right. Something is starting to change. And when that change happens, we want to be alerted to it. And what we do is in this portfolio, we naturally contract and bring down the exposure to equities. It's a natural process where we can expand or contract the equity exposure as we rebalance the portfolio. Now, here's the kicker. Right now, as of May 1st, we did another rebalance and we only had 40 stocks that came through the screen. So again, just a refresher where we were 6 months ago, 8 months ago, at about 65 to 70. Then 4 months ago, we were about 50. And here we are at 40. The least I've ever seen is about 30. Because certain stocks can always meet certain criteria. They do well. They're classic growers. So again, I ask the question, what does that tell us? What that tells us is something's not exactly right. Now, with the addition of the input that stocks are making new highs, we have to wonder, what is that based on? Why are stocks all of a sudden doing so well when we're seeing that fundamentals are not? One of the big issues here is this. There's a repricing going on. As we saw interest rates going up and the thought that they were going to continue going up for some time in the future, stocks were repricing at a higher interest rate environment. When you do a discounting calculation of figuring out what should be the price of a stock that is dependent either on growth or possibly a dividend discount model, what you do is you look at it and you put in an input of what the interest rate is, what the risk-free rate is. What is that? Depends on what you want to use. Do you want to use a 10-year? You want to use a 2-year treasury? You want to use something else of that nature? But basically what you're using is a forward discounting model that brings into the discussion interest rates. And as interest rates have gone up, or they were going up, stocks were repricing. People were saying, you know what, stocks aren't worth as much anymore, especially on a comparative basis. If I get 3.5% in a bond and I get 3.5% on a dividend in a stock, and then I have to also risk the fact that I could lose money in the stock, there's no guarantee of payback, et cetera. Whereas a bond, yes, is backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government, or maybe a corporate bond or a municipal bond. Maybe it's not as valuable. Maybe the benefit of having a stock doesn't outweigh the benefit of having a bond. You take into account the risk-free rate of return, the forward discounting mechanism also. So with that, now we have all of a sudden a change. Starting in the beginning of the year, the Fed has become a lot more dovish, even though this week they were a bit more hawkish. But they've been a lot more dovish, and we saw the prices of bonds reacted, and that took interest rates much lower, significantly lower. Now, as you're doing this in real time, stocks are being repriced once again for a lower interest rate environment. There you have it. If the question was, why are stocks doing so well? One of the big reasons is that interest rates are a lot lower. And again, a simple valuation process. There's a lot of valuation processes, a lot of ways to skin the cat. But a lot of fundamental investors will utilize a very reasonable level of growth at a reasonable price, or possibly even looking at a dividend discount model, looking at PE ratios compared to forward earnings and PEG ratios, et cetera. But one of the things a lot of them do is utilize a risk-free rate of return inside of their modeling. And as such, when we look at that, what we're seeing is that there is a significant amount of opportunity for stocks to go higher as interest rates go lower. That's what happened for the last 10 years before Powell started raising interest rates. So stocks become a much better investment vehicle in an environment that there's lower interest rates. So that kind of gives us a really good insight right there. However, I go back to this now, and I see that the fundamentals are starting to, well, slow down, at least from what we could see. The fact that stocks are not making it through this screen is telling me something. And what that tells me is there is a mismatch. Now, that mismatch may not stay for long, and that mismatch may not stay forever. But what it does is, when you have this mismatch, something's got to catch up. It's going to be one or the other. Either fundamentals are going to catch up to valuations, or the valuation is going to catch down to fundamentals in this kind of environment. Whereas we see that PE ratios have been expanded dramatically and fundamentals are not there, where earnings are slowing down, where revenues are slowing down. And we have is an environment that now one of two things are going to happen. I would venture to say that we're going to see some consolidation, and we're going to probably see some, I think, excess volatility that comes into the play here as the realization of what's going on is happening, that the Fed, which was out of play, and even the Fed fund futures right now are, for the first time in many months, are saying there's not going to be a rate hike or a rate cut for 2019. However, we're seeing a 3.6% unemployment rate. We're seeing that, you know, upwards of 275,000 people are being added to the payrolls. We're seeing that the initial claims numbers are like at the 210,000 range, 220. We're seeing that everything else seems to be okay. However, with the caveat that, again, some areas are slowing down, like manufacturing and retail sales are just going nowhere. And we're seeing that the underlying fundamentals of the economy are starting to weaken a little bit. You got to wonder how much longer, if we keep on plodding along at these kind of levels, that the Fed is going to say, oh, okay, yeah, we're not going to do any more rate hikes. We're going to be really dovish. Last week, there was no rate hike, right? We know that on Wednesday, there was an announcement, no rate hike. Powell came out to speak, and he sounded a little bit more hawkish. His conversation about inflation and its transitory was kind of interesting. A little bit of a change in what he was talking about, and the way he described inflation kind of freaked out Marcus, because he was believing and he's stating that this low inflation rate is transitory. Now, this is something that the Fed has talked about forever. You know, this whole idea that, oh, this low inflation, this is nothing. Don't worry about it. It's going to pick up. We have the tools. We have all the things that we're doing. We're going to see that meet our 2% requirement that they put on inflation. And, you know, things are going to get better. And we're going to see this environment of growth and inflation. We're going to see this really, you know, this Goldilocks environment where we can have our cake and eat it too in all circumstances. We can have rates going higher, markets going higher, bonds staying solid, and at the same time, the economy chugging along and growing significantly. We'll see. One of the things we've been hearing about quite often in the last, how long has it been? I would say 3 weeks, is a new narrative. It's always one. There's always something. But this new narrative is the idea that there's going to be a melt-up. And it's time to take a look at this and find out, what exactly are the definitions of a melt-up? What are they talking about here? How are they, you know, what does it mean to us as investors? So I grabbed the definition just right off the web, and I want to read it to you, and then I want to go through some of this. So a melt-up is a dramatic and unexpected improvement in the investment performance of an asset class, driven partly by a stampede of investors who don't want to miss out on its rise. Rather than by fundamental improvements in the economy, gains that a melt-up creates are considered to be unreliable indications of the direction of the market, and is unreliable in the direction that it's ultimately heading. Melt-ups often precede meltdowns. I think that's an important part of this whole definition right there. Melt-ups often precede meltdowns. So in summary, what they're talking about here is that we have this idea that FOMO, right? Maybe that's another way of describing it. People don't want to miss out on it regardless of the underlying fundamentals, anything, right? It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter the news, doesn't matter the fundamentals, doesn't matter anything more than, oh my God, I got to get into this. And what's happening is there's a lot of talk about this melt up because there's money on the sidelines. We've heard this so many times before. There's money on the sidelines. You know, one of the things I've talked about, I think it was with Frank Curzio a couple of times in the past, over the years, when we started hearing about this money on the sidelines concept was, there's always money on the sidelines. There's a certain amount of cash that needs to be held for one reason or another, and there's a certain amount of money that's set aside. Money on the sidelines also doesn't have to necessarily be invested in stocks. It could be in bonds, in real estate, in gold, in Bitcoin. It could be, I don't know, anywhere. This money on the sidelines discussion, I think, is a little bit, I think it's questionable. Let's say that. Now, Larry Fink from BlackRock last week, he said this, and I quote, "We have a risk of a melt-up, not a meltdown here. Despite where the markets are in equities, we have not seen money being put to work." He was on CNBC, he said this. He continued to say, "We have record amounts of money in cash. We still see outflows into retail, into equities and institutions." We still see outflows in retail, in equities, and in institutions. What does he mean by that? In other words, retail investors, institutions are still taking money out of the markets. Well, how is that? How is money coming out of the markets at the same time we're seeing record highs? Well, we talked about that a few weeks ago when we looked very closely. I think we did this on DH Unplugged. And that's Tuesday nights, by the way, with John C. Dvorak and myself. We have a podcast that's really good. You really will enjoy it. But what we saw with that was that the major buyer of stocks is not individuals, it's not institutions, it's not pension plans. Over the last number of years, the major buyer has been companies themselves buying back their own shares or M&A activity. But companies buying back the shares, that's where the majority of this is going on. So while Larry Fink, smart guy, brilliant guy, not taking anything away from him, a little bit, you know, hopeful that more money comes into BlackRock, of course, talking his book a little bit here. But we're also seeing plenty of talk from sell-side analysts and sell-side companies regarding the potential for this whole idea, this notion that there's going to be a melt-up. And the reason for that is, as I see it, because there was something else said here. They're giving you some ideas on how to invest in it. And how do you invest in it? Well, if you want to get in on the action and you want to do it in a big way and you want to leverage it up because there's going to be this melt-up, hey, you know what? I have a great idea. Let's buy call options. Great way to play the potential. That's what they're saying. That's what the sell-side analysts have been talking about, is buying call options and options to play the upside opportunity in this supposed melt-up that's going to happen, this absolute, sometimes you also call it, when it happens with a stock, you can call it a blow-off top, where you see the momentum building, it continues to build, people say, oh my God, I'm not buying it because it's too high here, and it keeps on going up, and people are like, oh, wow, look at that. Missed out on it. Keeps on going up like, oh my God, I got to get this because it's going to go up to the moon. Exact. Think about Bitcoin, what happened with Bitcoin. People get crazy with that because emotions take over the whole process and they don't look at, again, not everybody, not our listeners. You know, we're here discussing, you know, all the ways to make sure that you make good financial investment decisions. But you know what? There are a lot of people that are just chasing returns. They're going out there and just putting their money to work in something that moves up and that's it, without any understanding about even technicals or fundamentals or the not questioning and asking why, what's my stop out here? Where do I want to invest? Is this long term? Is this short term? They're not looking at anything. They're just saying, it's moving, I'm buying. But I find this whole idea by the sell side trying to come across and inflame the situation, almost talk ourselves into this idea of a melt-up, and then on top of it, putting a very high-cost, high-commissioned product on top of it as the recommendation on how to track it and how to prosper from it. Would self-serving be too light? It seems to me that it's similar to, what is it similar to? Like the real estate, okay. So do you remember the real estate boom that we saw back 10, 15 years ago, right? And banks were pushing money on people in the way of mortgages. Well, you know, you can get a mortgage. Well, I don't have any income. It doesn't matter. You got a house as collateral that you're going to have on this. And they were talking about how this real estate boom was going to continue and prices are going to go higher because we have a lot more people in the country and the real estate is really the greatest thing, the last frontier in investing, and why not put a lot of money into it? And not only that, we're going to give you the opportunity because it's such a great deal to mortgage your current house, take the money out of it, do a second, buy another house, and then when that goes up, use that as an ATM, take more money out of that second house, and spend it. Buy now. Here you go. Here's a mortgage. It's kind of the same thing in a different wrapper. Not exactly the same. I mean, of course, markets are more efficient than real estate because real estate is much more difficult to buy and sell in and out of. It takes a lot longer to do the transaction. That's obvious. But I think that this idea of a melt-up without the secondary discussion of what happens usually after the party ends, you know, the hangover, that's not being discussed. And I think that's kind of suspect. I find that to be very distasteful, dishonest. And to be honest with you, it's just to be once again bringing in the individuals, treating them like suckers, not providing all the information. Of course, regulators don't do anything about this. This will continue on forever. Just be on your toes and watch for this. Now, whether or not we do see a melt-up is a whole different animal. I think we're starting to see it a little bit now, but how long is that going to last? And when is reality going to hit? And when is that hangover going to be? How long after? And how much is our heads going to hurt? I mean, is it going to be a quickie? Kind of waking up, feeling groggy, got the head hurts a little bit from the alcohol, and then it's over. Or is it going to be something much more different? And the problem with this blow-off top concept, which again, we haven't seen yet, is these meltdowns have usually followed on a regular basis. You could see it all over the place. We've seen it so many times with individual stocks where the chasing gets and the euphoria comes and all of a sudden this anxious style push, the FOMO, the incredible amount of excitement, and it becomes ridiculous, just blasts higher. And then 2 days later with a stock, it usually rolls over a bit. It's hard to find blow off tops. When you find them, you can ride them real quickly, get the heck out of them, and then go the other way. So I guess that begs the question, where are we going in these markets? And I think the answer is, it's very complicated, but I think there's one thing that we should all potentially agree on. And that is that there's no need to guess at this point. Trying to get ahead of a trend can really cause problems. If you ever watched the movie The Big Short, so in the end, it worked out perfectly. In between, two or three years, the money wouldn't have lasted if it wasn't for some incredible amount of luck. You could be right about a trend, a direction, an opportunity, but if you don't have the ability to withstand the pressure when you're not right, it ends up being a loss. So there's no need, in my opinion, right now to necessarily get ahead of a trend. You can watch the price action, the volume, the sentiment, and then from there, you can move into positioning. Trying to get ahead of it right now can really create some problems. I'm not suggesting you shouldn't be short. I'm not suggesting you shouldn't be long. I'm not saying there's going to be this theoretical melt-up that a lot of talking about. I'm not saying there's not going to be. All I'm saying is maybe stay with the trend, which is, yes, up right now, until you see some real signs of things buckling. Yes, I've discussed in the beginning that, hey, fundamentals are telling me something different than we're seeing now. And I've said that all this talk about a melt-up is coming in. And yes, the economy in terms of unemployment is doing much better. Maybe we'll have a trade deal that happens. I don't know. Just be careful not to get too far ahead of a trend. Or let me say it differently. Don't get too, don't become so ingrained in one direction or the other that you're unable to, unwilling to bend that maybe right now is not the time. So we're talking about more, not that you're right or wrong, that there won't be either a melt up or a meltdown, but when does it happen? Because most of the profits that you're going to make are making sure to get it when the trend turns one direction or the other, or staying with the trend in a direction. Switching gears here, I think it'd be a good idea to spend a little time talking about what's going on with Amazon. We saw that earnings came out last week or so. Past earnings, there was some selling right after the print. There was some concern about some of the profitability. And then we saw recovery. Then we saw a drop again. And it actually dropped below key support. 1900 was a key support level for Amazon, but it started going down and drifting lower. And then all of a sudden, a day later, there was a comment by Warren Buffett that pushed the stock by about, I think it was about 60 points higher on Friday. I thought we would do is just quickly examine exactly what was said, because there was, I think there's a differential in what people were looking at, what they heard, and what was actually said.
I got the chance to speak to Buffett last night, and usually he tells us every once in a while what he's buying. This time, though, he told us what he's not buying.
I'll tell you one thing you'll see in the 13F, which comes out in a couple of weeks, which may cause you to ask me that question in 2 weeks, but doesn't really, is not significant from my standpoint. One of the two other fellows in the office that manage money.
Todd and Ted.
One of them bought some Amazon, but so it'll show up on the 13F. It is not true to say that I am buying Amazon. It's true to say that Berkshire has bought whatever shows up there.
Although you've been a fan of Amazon and Jeff Bezos for a long time.
Yeah, I've been a fan, and I've been an idiot for not buying them. But I just want you to know that it's no personality changes taking place or anything. It's somebody else's.
You know, that was interesting because he went to great lengths to talk about how he isn't buying it. Did you also notice the change in his voice when he mentioned that other people in the office are buying it? He went really soft. I mean, I'm not trying to get a little weird on you here, but it just was very clear that he was making a major effort not to say that he was buying it himself, that it was done inside the office. Now, I don't know how much is going to be showing up in the 13F, and if it was personal account money for the traders or if it was Berkshire money. It was obviously sounding like it was Berkshire money, but it wasn't Core Holdings, and it wasn't an investment by Warren Buffett. And that was really interesting because at first there was this thought that, well, he's buying it, and then, well, he's not. He made it clear and clarified that. And there was other discussion. I mean, it seems to me there is some confusion about exactly what is going on here, but I think this is another sign of what we talked about a moment ago about the idea that people are just buying it to buy it, to get into it, to just get in there. But the point here is that there is some kind of weird market action going on right now with a lot of people where they're just going out and looking at their money and say, you know what? Well, somebody else is doing it and I'm just going to do it. That could be reckless and it could be very detrimental. I'm not saying I don't like Amazon. I love Amazon. Love it. Love Amazon. As a matter of fact, it made it through our cut. And it's been one of those stocks that has been on the, on the board, but I'm just saying this last move here is a little bit weird. As a matter of fact, we were thinking about possibly shorting it. I have a small position short, and that's not why I'm talking about this. I just find this last move a little bit strange that goes into our discussion about the blow off tops and the melt ups and the fact that people are doing some strange things with their money. And just one more thing before we let this part go here, Cramer had a little bit of a meltdown last week. I don't know if you saw this, but he was talking about Tesla and Elon Musk and some not some positive commentary. And I guess Musk tweeted out and responded that he was shallow and transparent and a fake and this and that. And I just thought I'd bring it on only because, first of all, I got this new Rodecaster and I get to do all these cool things with it. But also because I thought it was really kind of, I thought it was weird. The whole commentary and how it played out. And just listen to this Kramer clip and tell me what you think about this.
Jim, I want to kick off our show by talking about Elon Musk's tweet last night. Now, he called you shallow, fake. Can you give me that definition of that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's always soul-searching when you've got Elon, late 40s man. My father, in when I came home, second grade, Mrs. Turov's class, I got a B in history. And my father said that I was faking. I wasn't doing enough work. That's the last person who's basically accused me of being a shallow fake. So it's kind of Shakespearean, Oedipus-like. And I've been struggling with it because do I want to be a deep fake, meaning that I am a rigorous fake? Or a shallow fake means perhaps I have work to do in order to be less of a fake, but not since my father. And it made me feel that I was going to be tracked in the dumb class as anyone accused me of this level of lack of rigor. And I was tracked in the dumb class. I was tracked in the fourth row of the of the different tiers at school and didn't emerge from it until I went to Harvard. So I think that Elon is basically offering a soul-searching moment for me, and I've come back and decided that maybe he's right. You wake up in the middle of the night and you have that dream where you're fake. I've had it. So there's something deep to even his shallow.
I don't even know what to say. I don't know what he's talking about there. Do you know what he's talking about? I mean, he was reflecting back to his dad and being called a fake, but shallow because he didn't study and he was in the second grade, fourth row, and it's getting a little weird out there. But, you know, that's the problem. That's the problem with social media and when you have some facts that you're trying to bring across and then someone just turns around and then what they do is they don't fight fire with fire. They're not coming back and showing the facts and saying, you know what, no, your information is wrong. Our production numbers are actually going to be this, or we're going to actually meet these particular goals because of this or whatever it is. They come back with a slam on you personally. How do you operate like that? And then what happens is it puts you on the defense. And those people that don't even care about any of the information, just care about the slams and care about following. We know about what I'm talking about here. Across the entire social media space, it's become a real a difficult way to transact when it's all personal. And we've seen that with politicians. And now all of a sudden we're starting to see what wasn't a name-calling process, aside from certain players on the political stand, now starting to spread. Just this weekend, Joe Biden started calling President Trump a clown. So now we're going to have a name calling, and that's going to now probably take this whole thing to a new level of low. Just weird. The whole Kramer thing was weird too. I just thought I'd play that because I thought it was interesting. Well, where are we? Let's take a look at some economics for the week. Why don't we? I want to go through, let's see what I have in front. Okay. I want to go through last week's economics. I thought it was a couple things in there that we should talk about. We did talk already about the unemployment number at 3.6%, as we know, and plenty of jobs being added to the payrolls. I'll mention also last week that ISM non-manufacturing came in at 55.5, still above the 50 level that's considered expansionary. So that's really good. Down from 57, actually down from 56.1. So we're down a little bit. Expectations were a bit higher, about 57. When that number came out, markets rolled down a little bit, ever so slightly, and then just threw that away and went higher for the rest of the day. We also saw the consumer confidence last week was a little bit higher than was anticipated, and it was higher than the month before. That's good numbers. PCE price index, which is a number for the inflation that the Fed is, that's their preferred inflation number, not moving at all, 0.1 to the upside. Next week coming out, let's see what we have here. Lighter week, much lighter week. Last week, there was just chock full of information. I'm looking at a whole page with construction spending. The ISM manufacturing came out of 52.8, by the way. That was very low. So the combination between ISM, the composite between ISM manufacturing and non-manufacturing, or ISM services, the new name for ISM non-manufacturing, is a bit lower right now, showing that the economy has been slowing a little bit. That also blends into the discussion we had about that wonky GDP number from the week before, that 3.2% GDP number that really was boosted by about a 0.7% increase in inventories that is not going to be there in the future. I can't imagine it. Some weird number that got played in there. Next week, really, Tuesday, Monday is nothing on Monday. Tuesday, we got some consumer credit number coming out, jobs numbers, mortgage applications on Wednesday, crude inventories on Wednesday. We'll see if there's going to be a build. There was a pretty substantial build last month or last week. Thursday, we got initial claims. We got PPI and core PPI coming out as well next week. So we're going to see actually on the same day, on Thursday, expectations are for about a 0.2% increase in total on both. Last month, we saw a really big rise in PPI, 0.6% increase. That was pretty hot. We'll see if that flows down into PPI. Analysts are not expecting that it did for some reason. Wholesale inventories, we're going to see that as well. And looks like there's going to be a slight, actually no rise in inventories. I take it back. Let's rewind for a second, just for a moment. PPI is expected to be 0.2. That's out on Thursday. On Friday is CPI, and now that I'm looking at this a little bit clearer with my old age eyeballs, it looks like it is going to flow down from the month before. They're expecting a 0.4% increase in CPI, 0.3 on core CPI. But that does show a flow through from the prior PPI, because the PPI is the producer price index. It's the wholesale price. It's the price increases that basically are on the manufacturing side. So what you have is a situation where you have manufacturing has increased in price. Usually what happens is one of two things. Either you're going to see a margin squeeze, because it's going to pass down and pass on to the consumer. So now what we're seeing is that last month's 0.6% looks like it's going to translate, at least from an expectation standpoint, to a 0.4% increase of CPI this month. That will definitely go right into play with Powell's discussion of transitory inflation. And if it does, we're going to see some inflationary numbers. That's the bottom line here. Inflation is going to be picking up, and that does make sense. Now, how long will that stay? How long is that transitory? Where do we go from there? Whole different discussion. Are we going to finally see that runaway inflation? Here's something that's really interesting. On Friday, when we saw the number come out on jobs, we saw a really hot jobs number. What was really fascinating about that jobs number was the dollar dipped down. Gold went higher initially because the idea was, oh, wait a second. Yes, this is strong numbers. There's no question about this. Anything you look at here, strong. However, when it comes to the numbers themselves, does this mean that things are picking up so incredibly strong that now with all the other people working and the extra people that are on the payrolls and now the wages that are increasing slightly, that we're going to see, dare I say it, runaway inflation. I don't think so. I think that the basic components to cause that, unless something really weird happens, are just not there. Economies are much different than they were years ago. And because of technology, aging, inflation is not as, it's possible, but not as probable in a runaway fashion. I mean, like 10%, 11%, you know, inflation here. Anything's possible. You keep on debasing the currency, you know, eventually something's going to break. You keep on keeping interest rates low. You do tax incentives, have massive debt. Eventually something's going to break. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if we had some inflation in the near term. Runaway, not so much. But nonetheless, there is hints that inflation is picking up to a level that may cause, finally, the gold to start ramping back up again. But again, I don't think that's too probable to be anything really significant and worrisome. All right, with that, we're going to end our show. We have we're starting to line up our guests again. Again, we moved our office and kind of pushed guests off for a little while, got some new equipment, had to do some testing. Give me your feedback. How did this episode sound? Be critical if you want. For all of you audiophiles, make sure you listen with headphones on, very tight, no noise in the room. How did this whole thing sound differently maybe than our other podcasts that we've done just last week, for that matter? Is it sound better? Is it worse? Is it too loud, too soft? Is it too deep, too high, too nasal? Sound artificial? I got all the other equipment. I didn't throw anything away. So just in case this doesn't sound so good, even though I tried to do all the settings just right here, let me know what you think. You can also get in touch with us by going over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and clicking on the Ask Andrew section and simply just putting a comment, a concern, a request, a question that we will answer on the air. And of course, I want to mention once again, the month of May, Investology, go over there, sign up, open an account, fund an account, and we will send you a signed book, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success, as well as a really cool Investology challenge coin. Until next week, I thank you for joining me, and I'll see you then. Bye-bye. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.